Welcome to Go West Young Podcast, the show about your public lands and the great outdoors from the Center for Western Priorities. My name is Aaron Weiss, coming to you this week from the conference room at the CWP offices in Denver, Colorado. If this is your first time finding us, welcome. Normally, we're going to start each podcast with a quick look at what's making news across our public lands this week. But today, we are all news, all the time. We're going to try to make sense of the election last week and what a Donald Trump presidency, still getting used to saying that, will mean for public lands and the American West. We will also consider how the election could change President Obama's priorities for his final months in office. So, joining me here in Denver, Jen Rokola, Executive Director at the Center for Western Priorities.
Hello. Great to be here this afternoon.
Jesse Prentice-Dunn, our Advocacy Director.
Hey there.
And at CWP's West Slope office in Montrose, Colorado, our Deputy Director, Greg Zimmerman.
Hey, guys.
Hey, all right, we're going to bring some more guests on board later on, including Craig Fairman. He wrote two must-read pieces leading up to the election for 538 and Outside Magazine. And we're going to do a deep dive into what happened in two key western states, Nevada and Montana. But first off, guys, I want to talk about President-elect Donald Trump. All right, we're going to start with the obvious question, Greg. What do we know about his positions on parks and public lands?
I think like so much, we know very little about where President-elect Donald Trump stands on public lands. Early in the campaign, we heard some indication from him that he was a supporter of public lands. He spoke out very strongly against efforts by a fringe of lawmakers in the West who want to have the U.S. government dispose of public lands into state and private hands. But since then, we've heard very little. And, you know, we've also seen some indications in recent days that that he could be one of the most industry and development friendly presidents that we've ever seen. There are indications that he could staff his administration with oil and gas executives. We don't know a lot. We do know that his son, Donald Trump Jr., is a sportsman and considers himself a strong conservationist. And we've certainly seen his son have some influence. So, there's some hope, but also some concern for those of us who care about protecting our public lands and ensuring a strong recreation economy for the West.
So on the campaign trail, during the campaign, Donald Trump talked about getting coal miners back to work and also increasing oil and gas production. Jen, is there any way to do both of those at the same time?
You know, I think that's probably going to be a hard promise for President Trump to keep. He made that promise, over the last year that he was going to bring coal jobs back to these communities. And you see this in the headline in the Wall Street Journal over the weekend, that cheap gas tests Trump's promise to revive coal. I mean, the problem is that coal just doesn't compete with natural gas. And so, he can make a lot of promises, but I think, when the rubber hits the road, there's no way he can bring back coal jobs when the market isn't going to make that happen.
Absolutely. And I would note that with President Trump's intention of opening more lands to drilling and increasing the amount of oil and gas produced, that has the potential to lower prices even further, making it even harder for a resurgence of coal jobs.
And we did already see some of this even from Mitch McConnell over the weekend, who after, we've heard for the last 8 years about a war on coal, and suddenly Mitch McConnell is acknowledging that bringing coal jobs back is a private sector problem and not a government thing. So, suddenly the tables have turned and it seems like there's even a realization in coal country that there's not going to be some magic switch to bring coal miners back to work.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with you, Aaron, but Trump is a candidate, traveled across the country in Appalachia, out here in the western part of Colorado, in Montana, saying that he was going to bring coal jobs back. And there are a lot of people who are hurting across the West because coal mines have had to shut down as a result of cheap natural gas and the transition from coal to natural gas. And this is a promise that I think could come back to bite President Trump, who's just not going to be able to uphold it. And you know, you've already seen news from a lot of Trump voters saying that if he doesn't deliver on some of these promises, then they're going to go the other way in 4 years. And I think when it comes to coal jobs, that's one promise he's not going to be able to deliver on.
I'm sure we're going to have a whole lot more to say over the next year or two about coal country and jobs and where those jobs may come from, if not the coal mines. I want to move right on right now to President Trump's cabinet. It seems to be the popular parlor game in D.C. right now. Politico had a big, long list of possibilities in many cabinet positions, including interior, which obviously is the one we're most interested here in the public lands world. A few of the names they mentioned in their list, Robert Grady, who's a Trump insider. He's a venture capital investor out of Jackson Hole. We saw Forrest Lucas and Harold Hamm, oil and gas CEOs, possibly a Western governor like a Butch Otter or a Sarah Palin. I suspect Robert Grady is the big unknown for most folks listening here. Jen, what do we know about him?
Actually, Robert Grady grew up in New Jersey, got his political start as a legislative assistant for a member of Congress from New Jersey, and worked for New Jersey Governor Thomas Keene. He is a close advisor to Chris Christie, and he was also served in the President George H.W. Bush's administration as the associate director of the Office of Management and Budget for Natural Resources, Energy, and Science. He's definitely not a household name, so we don't know a whole lot about him, and he probably doesn't have the star power to serve in a Trump administration.
All right, so what about these oil and gas CEOs, Forrest Lucas, Harold Hamm? Jesse, are these guys two sides of the same coin?
I suppose so, if oil and gas are the two sides of the coin. So Harold Hamm and Forrest Lucas are both CEOs of oil and gas companies. They do have some differences, though. Harold Hamm is from Oklahoma. He's been the CEO of Continental Resources for decades. They are one of the main oil and gas companies leading fracking in North Dakota. It's a tremendously profitable company, and he's quite a wealthy donor. He's been active in Republican circles, notably in 2012. He worked with Mitt Romney's transition team to develop an energy plan, which included trying to give states more control over the permitting of drilling and energy projects. Forrest Lucas is from Indiana. He's the head of Lucas Oil Company. If you're an NFL fan, you might have seen his name on Lucas Oil Stadium with the Indianapolis Colts. Their company makes a range of automotive oils, lubricants, and other products. And unlike Harold Hamm, he hasn't been as active in policies around extraction and public lands. He's been more focused on more animal rights issues. But in founding organizations that are anti-humane society, and generally seen as anti-animal rights.
So some of the priorities you wouldn't expect to see from an oil exec necessarily.
Quite possibly. But as with many of Trump's picks, we expect certainly an industry-friendly approach.
Sure. So, all right, let's talk about governors. You've got a long tradition there at Interior. Folks like Brooks Babbitt, Dirk Kempthorne come to mind. But when you add Sarah Palin to that list, Jen, it's a different ballgame.
Well, I think if Trump is looking to put a reality TV star into the cabinet, I think Sarah Palin is probably a pretty safe bet. Unfortunately, Sarah Palin is a mile wide and an inch deep. She served as Alaska governor, didn't even finish her term. She's most well known for her drill baby drill slogan from the 2008 presidential campaign when she was the vice presidential candidate for John McCain. You know, if Trump is going to look at Western governors, I would hope that he would expand his list and look at someone like Wyoming Governor Matt Mead or Nevada Governor Brian Sandoval. Both of those Republican governors have a reputation of reaching across the aisle, working with, Secretary of Interior Sally Jewell. They understand the West. They understand both the challenges and opportunities of what the Department of Interior needs to do in the West, whether it's sage grouse, energy development or the outdoor rec economy.
I suppose it's worth noting at this point that unlike some cabinet secretaries, interior is not a ceremonial position. This is a heavy policy wonk position that you have to be willing to dive in on the policy level, right?
You actually have to understand what the BLM does in the West, the Fish and Wildlife Service, the National Park Service. It's not a cabinet secretary. It's not a position where sound bites don't carry the day.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can all agree that Sarah Palin is a human dumpster fire and would probably be a catastrophe in the job. I mean, the one thing that she probably couldn't do is get a whole lot done, because I think she's a terribly ineffective person. But I think taking a step back and really looking at what the job takes, informs the kind of candidate that anyone should consider putting in. This is a really hard job. You're talking about managing hundreds of millions of acres on behalf of the American public and allowing for multiple uses. And being associated with the oil and gas industry isn't necessarily a bad thing. I mean, the current Interior Secretary, Sally Jewell, worked for the oil and gas industry in a previous life, but she also has other experiences. She's a business leader. She understands the strength of the outdoor economy to the West. And so I would certainly hope that the President-elect Trump would look for that kind of person who, may have some industry experience, but also understands the challenges of balancing multiple uses and collaborating and reaching across the aisle. And understands that our public lands aren't just for industrial uses. They're for many, many other uses as well.
All right, then real quickly, I got to ask, we've seen token across the aisle appointments in cabinets over the past several administrations. Any chance Trump would ask a Democrat to do this job? And is there any chance a Democrat would take it?
I don't see a Democrat joining the Trump administration, at least not as Secretary of the Interior. That is traditionally not a position that goes to a member of the opposite party. But I think Trump is unpredictable, so you never know.
We'll see when we see. Let's bring in Craig Fairman. He's a writer based out of Indiana who wrote two key stories for anyone following public lands and the election this year. The first for Outside Magazine focused on four races that could determine the fate of our public lands. The second was at 538, called All Politics is National, looking at how state politicians are following in the footsteps of Congress, mimicking the gridlock everyone hates in Washington. Craig, thank you very much for joining us.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right, so let's start with this Outside piece. We watched Colorado's 3rd Congressional District pretty closely here. That was the Scott Tipton-Gail Schwartz race. How did that one land on your radar?
Well, I actually came across that by talking to people at the Outdoor Industry Association. They highlighted some different races that were important, and this one immediately jumped out to me just because it was a nice example of how the public lands issues can really drive the conversation in a campaign. It wasn't just in debates or in conversations or in interviews with this one. It was the case of a TV ad that aired both on local TV and then, of course, went up on YouTube. And in it, the Democrat challenger used some really stirring Colorado scenery, I thought, to try to make the point at what was to try to make the point for what was at stake, and to show that the vote in a congressional race can have a big impact in terms of the public land debate more broadly.
So in terms of outcomes, Scott Tipton ended up holding on to that seat, but it certainly looked like Gail Schwartz forced him into some positions on public lands he hadn't necessarily taken or taken so explicitly before.
That's right, and it was also a closer race than you would expect for that district, given its history. And I think you can attribute that to the public lands debate and to the fact that voters on both sides of the aisle care quite a bit about it.
Let's move on to Montana. The governor's race there seemed to hinge on one public lands issue in particular, and that was stream access. What happened there?
Well, that was an interesting issue of the politics becoming personal. The Republican challenger was a man named Greg Gianforte. He was a pretty wealthy person, and we should just say as an aside that in Montana politics, there's been a lot of angst about wealthy outsiders coming to what is, of course, a very beautiful state and trying to change or control the state's very favorable public access laws because they build beautiful, gorgeous estates, not build, of course, but build houses on beautiful, gorgeous estates with the land. And then they don't want people to access them as freely as Montanans would like. And so in this case, I think that really hurt Gianforte, because there was a case in 2009 where a company owned by Gianforte sued the state trying to cut off access to a river that went next to some of his property. And it was really easy for people in Montana to see this as another case of a very wealthy person who bought a very nice piece of land and then tried to block regular people from accessing it the way they had for generations. And Gianforte's opponent, the incumbent Democratic Governor Steve Bullock, used that issue to great effect. During the debate, he actually pulled out a copy of the lawsuit to sort of underline his rhetorical point about this. Gianforte appealed to the moderators and said, "Hey, he's breaking the rules. I need to remind people of that." And Bullock had a very devastating response. "Well, I just want to remind people that my opponent sued the state of Montana."
At least it appears that worked. Bullock ended up winning re-election, certainly outpacing Hillary Clinton's vote in Montana. So your read on that, did the hits on Gianforte work?
I think this issue was one that really, like I said, struck a chord because there were so many pre-existing cases that followed that. It also helped that Bullock was the incumbent and that despite it being a very conservative state, he's worked effectively with legislators in Montana on a range of issues. And so I think people decided a vote for Bullock was a vote for keeping the state sort of moderate instead of sending it far to the right like Wyoming or North Dakota.
I want to turn to your 538 piece, which was long and very fascinating. Folks, if you haven't read it yet, go pull that up now. It starts with a story out of Montana, a little tiny town called Fairview on the border with North Dakota. This is a town that's in big trouble because of the oil boom across the border.
That's exactly right. But even more specifically, it's in trouble just because of the invisible state lines. There are so many factors that come into play here. Most of the oil is in North Dakota, which means that most of the tax dollars created by the extraction of that oil stays in North Dakota. Then you get into the fact that there are different tax policies in different states. So in North Dakota, the tax dollars go to the local communities. In Montana, the tax dollars go to the state. So Fairview had less chance at money to begin with, and even that smaller pile of money was not going to them. So it left them in a real bind where they couldn't provide basic services like sewage, water, roads, stuff that the townspeople had relied on, obviously, for generations from their community. They were in such a crunch from so many people coming in, but no commensurate uptick in tax revenue. And it really left them in a bind, and they needed their state to help them.
And did that help end up coming through the legislature?
Unfortunately, it did not. Montana has gone 6 years without passing a major infrastructure bill, which is pretty mind-boggling on its own. But what's happened again and again is you see partisan politics prevent something like an infrastructure bill from going through. And you can understand why partisan politics might impact should we expand Medicaid, an issue where there is a real right-left philosophical divide. But states have been providing infrastructure since we've had states. And so for an issue like that to become polarized, that to me was pretty shocking. But you're seeing it all around the country.
The story there out of Fairview really is representative of what's going on, especially across the West. I mean, you found some state legislatures in particular have gotten much, much more polarized over the last 20 years.
Sure. It's easy to find anecdotes like Fairview or like the public lands and focus on them, but I wanted to make sure that we could test that this was actually happening in a systemic and significant way. So I talked to a lot of political scientists. They create these amazing models where they go back and count thousands and thousands of votes. So we don't end up relying on, one bill or one legislator or one state even. We can see the broader trends. And these trends are very stark. What they show is that just like at the national level, that parties are getting further and further apart. Also like at the national level, the Republicans are moving further to the right than the Democrats are moving to the left. So you have a case now where there are dozens of states that are more conservative than Congress. You have dozens of states that are more polarized than Congress. And think for a second how dysfunctional Congress is. It's actually worse at the state level.
So you ended up finding that there is a civil war basically within the Republican Party in Montana right now.
That's right. And I think to go back to our earlier point, this is why Bullock was able to win re-election. it's always helpful to pay careful attention to state politics, because they'll never fall as neatly into the red or the blue pile as looking on a map on CNN will suggest. And so in Montana, you've got these moderate Republicans who actually come from the most rural districts. Obviously, in the national conversation, we've seen a lot about rural voters breaking for Donald Trump. But in Montana, at least, the most rural voters at the state level are more moderate, because they really need the state's money to help, whether it's with infrastructure like roads and sewage, or whether it's just with local hospitals. So the moderate Republicans have really struggled with a more conservative faction that's emerged, primarily suburban Republicans in the state legislature, and they've just kind of gone to war over what a state government should even be.
So as a Midwesterner diving into Western issues and land issues and tax issues, what surprised you as you did this research into Western politics?
Well, I guess what surprised me, and it really shouldn't have, but honestly, this surprises me again and again when I write political pieces, is the gap between what regular people want and what their legislators are attempting. Even with the public lands, you see polls that show 6 out of 10 people want public lands to stay the way they are in federal control. But then you have state legislators that are willing to spend millions of taxpayer dollars trying to lodge fruitless lawsuits to take over public lands at the state level. And it's not only a bad policy, it's not a representative policy. It's not what their voters want, but they continue to pursue it. And you can see the same thing in Montana. The people in Fairview obviously want their commodes to work when they flush them. But they have a state legislature that is playing partisan federal style politics instead of doing the things we've counted on states to do for generations.
So we're all playing the game, trying to guess what a Trump presidency is going to look like on our public lands. I don't know if you've got any particular insights there, or insights as an Indianan who's done some reporting on Vice President-elect Pence. Has he ever said anything about public lands issues coming out of Indiana?
Sure. I have not heard Pence speak about public lands issues, but what I can tell you about Mike Pence is he's a comprehensive conservative. His social stands get a lot of attention, and they are very far to the right, but he is consistently far to the right on every single issue. The only issue I can think of where he actually bucks party dogma is on in terms of journalists. He has a background in the media, and he's done some work for laws that protect the First and reinforce the First Amendment for journalists. But other than that, it's very hard to find a stance where Mike Pence doesn't follow his party. And so given what the Republican Party platform says about public lands, I think it's pretty clear where Mike Pence will fall.
All right. I want to open it up here real quick. Anyone else have any questions for Craig?
In terms of Utah's 4th Congressional District, I think we all saw that one is probably an uphill battle.
Refresh us. Who was it, that race?
It was the incumbent first-term Congresswoman Mia Love running against her opponent from 2012, Doug Owens. It was the Matheson seat, which Jim Matheson was a Democrat who held that seat for a number of terms, but tell us, why did you pick that seat, knowing that politically that was probably an uphill battle? Tell us about the public lands and how did they play out? How did the public lands issue play out in that race?
Sure. Well, I picked that race simply because it was the most competitive district in Utah. And one thing that's interesting to me about Utah, and you can see, again, that this is the same pattern that shows the link between national and state, between state and local, is that Utah's Utah's congressional delegation moves in mass. So all four of them end up signing the same letters or signing on the same and co-authoring the same legislation. So given the fact that they were all staking out very, very similar far-right stances on the public lands, I thought it was important to write about that and to pick the race that had the best chance to be competitive. The other thing I'll say is it's just important to highlight Utah because that's where this most recent wave really started. Again, this is something that started at the state level. It hasn't really proved very fruitful, but Utah has sort of been ground zero for a lot of this debate. And now I think the next step is for it to play out at the congressional and presidential level, and you'll see Utah's delegation leading the charge.
Yeah, you know, I have just one question for you. You know, there's been a lot of coverage, of course, about the influence of the industrial Midwest in this election and how Trump, at least for this election, was able to turn it red. You know, there hasn't been as much reporting about what happened in the West. And I'm just sort of wondering if you have any thoughts, you know, reading the tea leaves about why the West is moving the way that it is. You know, Colorado, of course, Senator Bennett won easily. Arizona was much closer than many expected, and Nevada was went solidly blue. And this is a story that hasn't necessarily broken through all the other coverage. But I'm curious if you have any insights into what's happening.
I think the answer I would reach for there is just demographics and the fact that the demographic shift explains it. I would also point to Hillary Clinton's ground game. I understand that her data operation and her ground game have received a lot of ridicule in the last few days, and deservedly so. But if you're going to make fun of her for never visiting Wisconsin after the primaries, a state she clearly should have spent more time in, you should also realize that she spent a lot of time in Arizona, and that might be a big explanation for why Arizona was a much different result than we might have expected. So it's a shift that's interesting, and I think it's a shift that the Democratic Party can continue to hope increases and continue to invest resources in.
All right. Craig Fairman has written for The New York Times, Washington Post, Slate, many other publications, most recently Outside Online and 538. We've got links to both those pieces in the show notes here. Craig, thank you so much for your insight and your time today.
No, thanks for having me.
All right, let's bring in two seasoned political operatives for their take on this election. Barrett Kaiser lives in Billings, Montana. He was state director for former Senator Max Baucus. He works with us here at CWP to help us understand Montana issues and politics. And Annette Magnus is with Battleborne Progress. She lives in or around Las Vegas. I don't know exactly where you live, Annette.
But I live in Las Vegas.
All right, welcome to both of you. Barrett, I want to start with you. You heard what Craig had to say about a GOP civil war in Montana. Is that fair? Is that what you're seeing on the ground there?
Well, absolutely. Last legislative session, you know, you saw a very, very deep schism between your sort of Tea Party faction, Republicans, and what we would call the Mod Squad, more moderate members of both the House and the Senate. And certainly the deck chairs have shifted slightly as a result of the most recent election. But by and large, I think that schism will continue to exist, and perhaps made more so by the Trump victory and whether or not some of the more conservative elements will feel emboldened by what's happening nationally, for sure. So it should be an interesting legislative session to watch, especially from a public land standpoint, and how that Mod Squad breaks along party lines vis-a-vis what we know to be very, very powerful polling and messaging when it comes to public lands management in the state of Montana. Certainly a big election year issue, and now we need to see how it plays out amongst policymakers in January.
Interesting. All right, Annette, in Nevada, there was a single Democratic seat that the GOP was hoping to pick up in the across the country this year. It was Harry Reid's seat, Harry Reid retiring. You were defending that seat, and Catherine Cortez Masto is about to become the first Latina in the U.S. Senate. Bottom line, what happened in Nevada this year?
Well, in Nevada, progressive groups worked very hard, and we got turnout up to where it needed to be. We worked up and down the ticket. It wasn't just a victory at the top, and we're very glad that Catherine Cortez Masto will be going to back to the U.S. Senate and representing us. And that was a very proud moment last Tuesday night to have that happen. But we also had victories up and down the ticket. We had, you know, congressional victories. We got rid of Crescent Hardy, which is a part of the Bundy caucus. Both of our chambers and our state legislature flipped control. We have two African-American men leading both of the majority caucuses in the Senate and Assembly. We have a supermajority in the Assembly now for the Democrats. And we won very important ballot initiatives here. So up and down the ticket, we had critical races in Nevada. And I think Nevada really does represent what the rest of the country is going to look like in the next 20 years. And so, you know, we are the new progressive majority in Nevada, and we're very proud of what we did on Tuesday.
So in addition to all of that, I've got to note that Hillary Clinton won Nevada, one of her obviously bright spots in a rather surprising election. So do you think, is this a permanent shift in the electoral map?
while we have a lot of work to do ahead of us, we have to make sure that 2018, where we typically don't do as well in terms of progressives and our issues, we have to make sure 2018 is a very good year for us. We have a lot of important races in 2018. All of our constitutional officers are up. We also have a governor that is being termed out, so that's going to be critical. We have our other Senate seat, which is currently held by Dean Heller, who has also been an obstructionist, up for grabs in 2018. So we have a lot of work to do in 2018, but we're ready, and we've already started to think about the road ahead and how we start making sure that our victories in 2016 don't end only in 2016.
You mentioned the Bundy caucus there. On the public lands front, you've got two big issues looming in Nevada right now. One is the push to create a Gold Butte National Monument, and the trial coming up in February of Clive and Bundy and his sons for that 2014 standoff. And Bundy, of course, lets his cattle run feral in Gold Butte. What's your feeling there on how these two, you know, issues interact, play off each other?
Well, I actually see them as two very different and two very separate issues. You know, the Bundy clan is a group of, you know, it's a vocal minority. And frankly, they are not even taken seriously in Southern Nevada. In fact, a lot of our candidates were running against Clive and Bundy because, if you can believe it, Clive and Bundy is even more toxic than Donald Trump is. And so for us, he was a great tool to use against these people like Victoria Seaman and Michelle Fiore and Crescent Hardy, because people in Nevada don't like Clive and Bundy. They don't appreciate what he stands for. They think he's a criminal because he is a criminal, and we just don't have time for him. So in terms of the Bundys, we have no tolerance for that nonsense. In terms of Goldview, which I view as a very separate issue, look, I'm a native Nevadan. I was born and raised in this place. I believe Gold Butte will be protected. It should be protected. It is one of our natural treasures in Nevada. It is one of the most spectacular places I've ever seen in my life, and I just love it. I go camping out there often. It's a beautiful place, and it deserves permanent protection. And I am fighting very hard right now to make sure that that gets done before the end of this administration's term, because I don't want it to fade away. There's so many important artifacts out there for our Native American friends and family members, and we just believe so strongly that it needs to be protected for future generations, and so we're fighting hard to make sure that happens.
As far as the Bundys go, and that the trial in Oregon, was there a feeling after that acquittal in Oregon, has this raised the stakes in Nevada? Is there an awareness there of that?
You know, I think what it highlighted was there was a miscarriage of justice done in Oregon. We know that they committed crimes, and we know that they are not law-abiding citizens. And so for me, again, I've separated the two issues. The Bundy situation is what it is. They're going to come now to Nevada. They're going to be on trial in Nevada. They're going to hopefully get the justice they deserve here, which is that they will be behind bars for a very long time. And that is a very different issue than making sure that we're protecting this sacred area for generations to come. You know, the Bundys, unfortunately, have somehow been tied to Gold Butte. But again, I separate the two things. I think Gold Butte is its own important place where we need to protect that land, and we need to make sure that we're protecting it for future generations so that people like Clive and Bundy can't ever go in and destroy it again. And that's what we're working towards right now. And, you know, what happens with the Bundy trial, we'll just pay attention and watch that. But that doesn't impact the work we're doing to make sure it's permanently protected.
Absolutely. Looking ahead in both states, you mentioned the Senate seat coming up in 2018 in Nevada. Barrett, in Montana, what's on the radar there for you?
Well, the big thing, of course, is John Tester, champion of public lands, outdoor recreation, access for hunting and fishing, conservation, is on the ballot. And after having served as chair of the DSCC this cycle, we anticipate him to have a real run and a lot of competition. And, you know, thankfully, you know, the public lands movement in Montana knows that he's a champion. But clearly the election results are cause for concern from everybody. But one thing I did want to say, and that is thanks to CWP and its Winning the West initiative, we know that the polling on public lands management, access to public lands, is a winner. And I think that the sort of Bundy contingent, the factions of people that think that just because Donald Trump was elected the president, that that means that they should continue with, you know, these failed policies of, you know, land transfer and other, you know, what I would call a ruse for, you know, increased development of natural resources, sales to public landowners that will, you know, build trophy homes and ranches and lock the public out. That should the mainstream politicians go along with that mantra and do the bidding in state capitals, they will pay a price at the elections booth as a result. And again, the polling is very clear, thanks to CWP's Winning the West initiative, that, you know, public lands is a winner in our state. So, you know, coming down the pike, we hope to see a couple of administrative things coming out of the administration to protect a few of our very special places here. Governor Bullock has an outdoor office of recreation proposal that he's going to try to move through the state legislature. That obviously will be a very big deal. But we also have, you know, important land and wildlife conservation objectives such as sage grouse and the Land and Water Conservation Fund. And so all of those things will continue. There's no question that, you know, we were delivered a wake-up call nationally. But, you know, thankfully, Governor Bullock is there as a goalie on, you know, key public lands and conservation issues. So we're going to keep fighting, and if anything, come back bigger, better, faster, and stronger next time.
One of the questions we've gotten here, I've gotten calls from reporters asking about with Trump's election, is this going to lead to a resurgence or a quieting down of extremist activities on public lands and these militants? So far, either Barrett or Annette, are you seeing any signs of that in either direction in Montana or Nevada?
I have not seen any signs of that, and I don't think we need to give them any credibility and allow them to do that. You know, again, they don't speak for the majority of Nevadans. We know that because of your polling that the majority of Nevadans overwhelmingly support protecting our public lands. They support making sure that we're protecting things like Goldview for future generations. And so they're not going to put up with that nonsense. There is no mandate here from Donald Trump. He didn't even win the popular vote. And so for me, any kind of hate-filled rhetoric or extremist rhetoric is a losing proposition, because Nevada is an example of how if you go ahead and tie yourself to these extremists, you will lose your election. And we have a handful of legislators who just experienced that. They ran on this land seizure proposition. They were supportive of the Bundy caucus, and they lost their election because people are not putting up with it. They do not tolerate this kind of nonsense. And so for us, you know, we're just going to keep reminding our legislators that this is a losing issue for them if they try and go down this road. Protecting our public lands is where they need to be on these issues. And the public expects them, Nevadans expect them to continue to preserve our natural treasures. And we will be there every step of the way to hold them accountable and make sure that these extremists do not talk for us.
Michelle Fiore ran for Congress, got creamed in the primary. Do you think we've finally seen the last of her?
She's going to figure out some way to weasel her way back in, but that's fine. Even if she does, we'll be right there to remind her of her extreme votes and her extreme stances on things. And, you know, that's what we did all the way through this election cycle. We were able to hold our elected officials accountable every step of the way. You know, Crescent Hardy, one of my favorite things we did this cycle, Crescent Hardy hosted Rob Bishop from Utah here in Nevada. And we went and we trolled Crescent Hardy at that hearing, and he was so angry at us for actually showing up and telling Nevadans what he was up to. And so these legislators know what they are doing is wrong. And so when you hold them accountable and say, tell the voters what they are doing, they don't like it because they don't want any of the voters knowing because they know they're wrong and they know the polling is not with them. So the more we can hold elected officials accountable and make sure that they're protecting our public lands, the better off we all will be over the next generations.
Speaking of trolling, Barrett, you were at Malheur in January, and you actually stormed the podium at one point after Ammon was done speaking. What did you think when you heard about the verdict, and any chance you want to come back and, you know, troll Ammon again in Nevada as the trial's coming up?
Aaron, had the exact same reaction that all of you guys did. Just utter shock, surprise. I was literally throwing stuff to a point where my 4.5-year-old son had to ask his mom why Papa was so upset. It's simply because I think it was just mentioned there was just this injustice associated with it all. We were there, we saw exactly what they had done, and obviously they're not walking around as free men, and there's a big situation still to go in Nevada, but it just was a real stunner. Whether it be, the Bundy verdict or the fact that Donald Trump was elected president of the United States, you have two options in life, right? And that is try or do nothing. And so what we choose to do is try, and that is through our advocacy work, through our educational efforts, on public lands management and the other things that we care so deeply about, we keep throwing punches, and ultimately the pendulum will swing in the other direction. I think that the fringe conservative extremist elements are about to make a huge mistake and grossly overcompensate where they are politically.
Hey Barrett, this is Greg. On that note, I think the seizurists are headed to Helena in the next legislative session there. What do you expect to see? What do you expect is going to happen when Jennifer Fielder, who's a senator from Montana, also the head of the American Lands Council, which is the primary advocate for disposing of public lands, what's going to happen this legislative session?
Well, I think she's going to run headlong into a Steve Bullock buzzsaw. Should it reach his desk, we know that he'll veto that legislation. As I had said previously, it remains to be seen how, motivated and, how much more sort of political cachet folks think they have as a result of the rise of a certain brand of conservatism nationally. I think that her proposals have been beaten back time and again. The American Lands Council, it's very clear to those of us who follow public lands issues, but also to mainstream public, that transferring federal management to the states simply does not work here. Firefighting costs alone would bankrupt our state. But we also have an aversion to out-of-staters coming in, buying up trophy properties where generations of Montanans have taken their children hunting and fishing, and erecting an 8-foot-tall fence and locking them out. We see it with the Wilkes brothers of Texas, and it's all interrelated and tied together. And at the end of the day, both House and Senate members are going to have to decide whether or not they want to side with, the Koch brothers-funded seizure movement and out-of-state billionaires, or the public who gets to use these lands that are held in public trust. That's what's going to come down to. And if it gets to Steve's desk, we know he'll veto it.
So, Barrett, you mentioned Governor Bullock, who just won his reelection. Montana is interesting in that the other statewide race this cycle was won by U.S. Representative Zinke, a Republican. Can you talk about kind of how these races and public lands can inform races in Montana going forward?
I would say over the last, two, maybe three cycles, but in particular this one, public lands have played out more so than we've seen in the past. almost every candidate, be they running for the state legislature, the PSC, the U.S. House, or the governorship, utilized public lands in some way, shape, or form in his or her messaging. So again, I think it goes back to CWP's Winning the West polling that shows that that really is a winning issue. And I know that your previous guest talked about how this issue played out in the governor's race with Greg Gianforte suing the state to block an easement that would allow people to access the East Gallatin River. That put Greg Gianforte on his heels for months at a time and kept him from really defining himself early in the race, and I think had a big part of why he lost after spending, you know, $6 million of his own money.
All right, I want to give Annette the last word. Getting back to Gold Butte, what is the single most spectacular part of Gold Butte and why it needs protection?
Little Finland is my favorite part. It is one of the most amazing rock formations I've ever seen. It's bright red as you can think of. And just the peaks and all of the different ways that the sun and the wind and the rain have carved these beautiful rock sculptures in the land. It's just the most amazing thing you'll ever see. And words can't even describe it. But what we know is that, you know, we have to protect it permanently for those things to be able to be seen by our kids and our grandkids and future generations going forward. And so we are calling on the president, President Obama, to protect this land because it is one of the most spectacular places I've ever seen in the state of Nevada, and it desperately needs to be protected.
All right. Annette Magnus, the executive director of Battleborne Progress in Nevada. Barrett Kaiser is a political strategist with Hilltop Public Solutions in Montana. Thank both of you so much for all your insight and taking the time today.
Thanks, all.
Thank you for having us.
Take care.
Let us turn to the final months of the Obama administration. There is a pretty long to-do list when it comes to public lands. We just talked about Gold Butte there. Jesse, what other national monuments could be in the works?
Well, we've seen quite a range of local campaigns around the country asking the president to designate national monuments. Two that really stand out are the Bears Ears National Monument proposal in southeastern Utah and a proposal in Arizona to protect the Greater Grand Canyon. In southeast Utah, a coalition of five Native American tribes have asked the president to designate a national monument covering roughly 1.9 million acres that they consider sacred. This area is chock full of ancestral ruins, rock art, petroglyphs, and has been threatened significantly by looting and vandalism over a period of decades. So that campaign is really has a broad range of support in asking the president to permanently protect it. And in Arizona, a similar coalition of supporters has asked the president to protect the Greater Grand Canyon. That's a 1.7 million acre proposal that would encompass the watersheds that drain into the Grand Canyon. It would include the Kaibab Plateau on the North Rim that has a wide range of forest land, prime wildlife habitat. So that's another one that we could see in the coming months.
So when they say Greater Grand Canyon, this is adjacent to the national park?
Yes, absolutely. And I should mention that this is an area that has had a lot of uranium mining over the years and a lot of mine claims in the area. And while the president has put in place a 20-year moratorium on uranium mining in the area, it's certainly a place that is deserving of permanent protection, seeing as it's draining into one of the seven wonders of the world.
All right, Mr. Advocacy Director, if people want to see these monuments happen, what should they do?
The tried and true method, call the White House and tell the president that you'd like to see these areas protected, and then do the same thing with your members of Congress.
Greg, I want to get into the weeds a little bit, talk about energy development on public lands. Could we see some final rulemaking coming out of Interior before the end of the president's term?
Yeah, I mean, I expect that we probably will. There's a big rule that I anticipate the Obama administration will try and complete to address methane leaks from oil and gas operations that are happening on public lands. This is a critically important rule. You know, the natural gas industry likes to tout the climate benefits of natural gas, But in order for there to be any benefits for climate, we need to make sure that methane, a very harmful greenhouse gas, isn't leaking from drill rigs and from pipes and other oil and gas operations. So this is an incredibly important rule. It's one that mimics a rule that's already exist in Colorado and has been supported by the oil and gas industry. And I anticipate that we will see the Obama administration finalizing that. And we're also going to see, I expect, in the coming days and weeks, the Obama administration actually finally clean up some of the really poorly leased areas during the George W. Bush administration. Two of these areas, the Roan Plateau and the Thompson Divide in Colorado, had leases issued. And the Obama administration has spent years trying to clean up those leases in places where development doesn't belong. There's competing interests, including wildlife habitat, hunting, fishing. The Obama administration is gonna ensure that these leases don't go forward, and I anticipate that we'll see those leases addressed in the coming days and weeks. I think it's we can be hopeful that we won't see a repeat of some of the mistakes that were made during the George W. Bush presidency under President Trump. Although I expect that we'll be back in the same place where lands that are critically important for other values are put up on the leasing block and sold off to oil and gas developers. And it's going to be contingent upon all of us to fight back.
So, Jen, if President Trump takes office after a flurry of late activity from the Obama administration, if President Trump wants to roll back new national monuments or new rules from Interior, how easy or hard would it be for him to do that?
You know, I think it would be very difficult. It would be unprecedented legally. I mean, the president has the authority under the Antiquities Act to designate national monuments to protect places that have historical, cultural significance. The Antiquities Act allows the president to protect these places. There's nothing in the Antiquities Act that says a president can roll that back. So I think if President Trump wants to reverse some of these decisions, I think it would be a significant legal fight, and there would be significant legal challenges if he decided to roll any of these monuments back. I think it would be very difficult.
Yeah, and you know, there's been some reporting suggesting that, you know, the president can just come into office and tear up rules. But the reality of the matter is that it's not that easy to do. I mean, a lot of these rules, these administrative rulemakings that have happened over the last 8 years are science-based. And in order to roll them back, it's going to require another rulemaking, and it's going to require the agency to show that their science was wrong. And the reality is that's not going to be the case. I mean, each one of these rules that the Obama administration has done have been based in science and what's best for the American public. So it's going to be very, very difficult for rules to get rolled back.
How are y'all feeling about the next 2 months? Very optimistic, cautiously optimistic, totally depressed?
You know, I'm not sure. I think just like everybody's wondering what exactly a Trump presidency is going to mean, I think there are a lot of ways that the last few months of an Obama administration could play out. And I think we've got a lot of things that are certainly worthy of being completed, and we can certainly hope. So if hopeful is a word, go with that.
I agree. I think I'm hopeful that the president will finish a lot of the unfinished work. And I think we have to look at and celebrate what President Obama has done for public lands over the course of these 8 years. He's protected more land and waters than any president in the history of this country. And I think that's something we all have to celebrate.
It's going to be certainly quite the track record. I'm sure we'll revisit that as we hit the closing days of the administration. Let's wrap up with some perspective. Taking a look back this week in Western history, 210 years ago, November 1806, Lieutenant Zebulon Pike was approaching the foothills of the Rocky Mountains during his second western expedition, searching for the headwaters of the Arkansas and the Red Rivers. He spotted a distant mountain that looked, quote, like a small blue cloud. So Lieutenant Pike, having never seen mountains of this size, you know, we're talking about the Rocky Mountains here, he had no idea what he was looking at. He told his men they should be able to walk there, climb it, and make it back to the expedition in time for dinner. So needless to say, that did not happen. They went 2 days without food in below zero temperatures. They finally took shelter in a cave rather than keep going through the waist-high snow. They never even reached the base of the mountain, much less getting anywhere near the summit. Lieutenant Pike later declared the peak impossible to scale. And the irony, of course, is that mountain bears his name, Pike's Peak. It's one of the most popular 14ers in all of Colorado. 15,000 people attempt the climb every year. 2,600 of them run it during the Pike's Peak ascent and marathon. Or, of course, you can take the easy way, just drive, or take the Cog Railway straight to the top. Jen, have you climbed?
I have not climbed Pike's Peak.
Driven it multiple times.
We got to go start bagging some 14ers. It's funny. There's a whole bizarre side story to this expedition. It appears the whole thing may have been a setup. The general who sent Lieutenant Pike out on this mission, James Wilkinson, turned out to have been a Spanish spy. He was on the payroll of the Spanish crown. It appears that he may have planned all along for Spanish troops to capture Lieutenant Pike and his men. That is exactly what happened. Pike and his men were taken to the capital of Chihuahua. All of his documents from the expedition were confiscated. The whole thing is kind of a bizarre side note on one of the most bizarre episodes in early American history, which was Aaron Burr's possible attempt to form a new nation in the Southwest and what's now Mexico. General Wilkinson was one of the partners in that scheme. They got caught sending coded letters back and forth. Wilkinson altered them to make himself look innocent and Burr look guilty. The whole thing totally weird. And if it wasn't for it, we might be calling Pike's Peak by some other name today. One other piece of Western history to note this week. It was this week in 1883 that time zones were created, and we have the Old West to thank for that, specifically the railroads. Up until then, most towns in the U.S. kept their own local time based on high noon, when the sun was literally at the highest point in the sky. That worked great, of course, when it took you a long time to get from town to town, because who cared? But once you've got trains that make town-to-town and state-to-state travel happen within a matter of hours, scheduling trains is suddenly a nightmare because every stop is in its own time zone. So it was the railroads that got together and created four time zones for the U.S. and Canada, and the dividing lines they came up with back in 1883 are still basically the same dividing lines we use today. It was the railroad system that became the de facto standard. Congress officially adopted time zones for the rest of the country in 1918. All right, that is it for this episode of Go West Young Podcast. If you like what you hear today, be sure to leave us a review on iTunes. It is the best way for other people to discover what we're up to here. You can also find us on Google Play, TuneIn, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. Thanks very much to our guests this week, Craig Fairman, Barrett Kaiser, Annette Magnus, and of course to our esteemed guests here at the Center for Western Priorities, Executive Director Jen Rokola.
Thank you.
Deputy Director Greg Zimmerman.
Thank you.
And our Advocacy Director, Jesse Prentice Dunn.
Thanks so much.
My name is Aaron Weiss. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for future episodes, please drop us a line. The address podcast@westernpriorities.org. Thanks very much for listening. We're going to go bag some 14ers, and we'll be back after Thanksgiving.